podcast series, Security for Business Leaders. The CERT program is part of the Software Engineering Institute, a federally funded research and development center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You can find out more about us at CERT.org. Show notes for today's conversation are available at the podcast website. My name is Julia Allen. I'm a principal researcher at CERT working on operational resilience. Today I'm very pleased to welcome George Siliwash and Lori Flynn. They are members of CERT's Insider Threat Center. And today, George, Lori, and I will be discussing the fourth edition of their team's Common Sense Guide to Mitigating Insider Threats. The guide describes 19 best practices for mitigating insider threat, and for our listeners' benefit as background, we have posted several podcasts on insider threat-related topics, including prior versions of the Common Sense Guide, which you're welcome to listen to as interest permits. So with no further ado, welcome, George.
Thanks, Julia. It's a pleasure to be here today to discuss the Common Sense Guide.
Great. And, Lori, we're also very glad to have you on the podcast series today. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, George, why don't you get us started? I have a few stage-setting questions for you. I know we've talked about insider threat before, as I said, on the podcast series, but I think for our listeners' benefit who are perhaps new to the topic, it would be helpful to refresh on CERT's definition of a malicious insider, if you would be so kind.
Sure. CERT defines an insider as a current or former employee, contractor, and even business partner who has or had access to an organization's system, network, or data. The insider has intentionally exceeded or used that access in a manner that typically negatively affected the confidentiality, integrity, or the availability of the organization's information or information system.
So it's someone who's had access in the past may still have access or may have left the organization. Is that correct?
Yes. So sometimes an insider may leave the organization. They either may be terminated or just choose to go on to other employment, and either the organization neglects to disable their access or they are unaware of a backdoor into the organization.
Great. Well, thank you. So, Lori, one of the things that I love about this body of work is that I know that it's based on having analyzed hundreds of cases and that your best practices derive from that analysis. So could you say a little bit about how many cases you've analyzed to date and how these are categorized? It'll help give our listeners an idea of the sources of data from which the practices derive.
Yes, the work is empirically based. We've analyzed more than 700 insider threat cases. We categorize them in five ways, as intellectual property or IP theft, fraud, IT sabotage, espionage, and everything that doesn't fit into those categories we call miscellaneous right now.
Okay.
The top six infrastructure sectors for the categories are banking and finance, IT, healthcare and public health. Two of the categories are government. Federal is one and state local is the other, and commercial facilities. And we've analyzed a total of 371 cases for this edition of the Common Sense Guide. We don't include discussion or analysis of our espionage cases, and all of the 371 cases are adjudicated, which means that in a court of law, the insider was found guilty.
You know, I've always been interested in that aspect of it, the fact that you select cases and then you ensure that the cases have been adjudicated, the insider has been brought to justice. It seems to me those kinds of cases are really hard to find, aren't they? Or do you now have established trust sources that allow you to really track when a new insider threat case is ready for your analysis?
Well, we have a process where coders monitor media sources for new insider threat cases. And additionally, we get some of our cases from organizations, law enforcement organizations like the U.S. Secret Service and the FBI, who identify new cases that we wouldn't necessarily have heard of through the media sources. Some of our cases are brought to our attention by businesses who, again, don't necessarily report their cases to the media, but do want to get the benefit of our insight into insider threats, and also to give us information to draw new analyses from. And
Laura, you make a very good point there too. A lot of our cases that we find out about come from media sources, and a lot of times organizations just don't want to report about an insider that might have compromised organization. I mean, who wants to actually admit that something happened to their organization and it could negatively affect them, either financially or other means? So this is another big challenge when it comes to collecting data about cases as well.
That brings to mind the U.S. Secret Service and CERT and various other organizations put together an annual survey about insider threat, and we've found, according to our survey results, about 76% of insider threat cases are not reported to law enforcement or media. They're kept in-house for reasons such as an organization not having enough proof to feel that it's worth it to try the case in a court of law. There's too much risk of losing. And also there's a lot of concern about bad media exposure.
Sure, and a lot of organizations, too, just choose to handle the incident internally, either terminate the employee or through other some administrative action against that employee. So oftentimes it might not even raise to the level where it's actually reported out to news sources or anything like that.
Right. So I think the important point to make for our conversation today is you have many cases that you analyze, but the ones on which the common sense guide is based have been adjudicated, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, George, let's talk a little bit more about the structure of this new guide and what's new about it, and then what we're going to do is get into a few of the new practices.
Sure.
So could you summarize some of the key differences and improvements that are reflected in this guide compared to the third edition, which was published in January of 2009?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, the Common Sense Guide has undergone a number of changes and enhancements since the third version. For starters, we've analyzed more cases, which have allowed us to update the guide to include information about what we're seeing across various types of organizations. This has also helped us to develop four new best practices. We've refreshed the existing 15 best practices and actually folded one of the other practices into others. That would be the software engineering or software development process that was folded in amongst the other ones that are in the guide. We also included one or more case examples in each best practice from our database where it was possible. And another feature of version 4 of the guide is that it addresses a range of roles across an organization. For example, we talk about HR, legal, physical security, data owners, information technology, and even information assurance and software engineering. The Common Sense Guide has actually been, I think, made easier to use by including a chart at the top that basically tells you which area of the organization that practice is addressing. It's just like a little checkbox across the top. And we also include appendices in the document that are tailored to those specific roles, too. One of the things we also did to increase the usability of the guide was to include a quick wins and high-impact solutions section for each of the best practices. There are a list of suggested quick wins for jump-starting your organization's insider threat program. They're also tailored to large and small organizations as well. And finally, the organizations that implement best practices or other standards within their organization, such as NIST and ISO, will find the guide even more useful because we include mappings to NIST 853, also to ISO 27002, and CERT's Resilience Management Model, or CERT-RMM.
You know, I think about, this is great, George, because I think about this jumpstart idea because when faced with, you know, 19 practices, all these cases, kind of this overwhelming, because insider threat is obviously just one aspect of security that an organization needs to be addressed. So I think the quick win, you know, a place to start, to take an initial step, have you gotten some good feedback on including that information in the guide?
Since the guide's just been released, we haven't received a lot of feedback yet, but I suspect that this is going to help a lot of organizations implement a insider threat program within their company or within their business. I think that this will at least help get the practices moving, help the organization get on a path to reducing or mitigating insider threats. We talk about some of the things a small business can do and some things a large business can do. Generally, you know, large organizations have more funding for this type of security measures they might have to implement, whereas a small business might not have that same ability. But we try to address that with the quick wins by saying that some of these can be applied to both types of organizations as well.
Right, because what we've found in a lot of our process improvement experience at the SEI is if you can tackle something that sometimes we refer to as low-hanging fruit or something that gives a quick win in a reasonable period of time, that win or that benefit can generate momentum for implementing more of the practices in, for example, in an insider threat program. So I think that's really a nice addition. So let's talk about, dig into the guide a little bit. As we said earlier, this fourth edition describes 19 best practices, 4 new and 15 updated, that derive from the cases that Lori described. And while we don't have time to cover all of these, really encourage our listeners to take a look at the guide. I would like to spend a little bit of time on the 4 new practices. So, George, if you would get us started, practice 9, I'll refer to these by number, is called Define Explicit Security Agreement for Any Cloud Services, especially Access Restrictions and Monitoring Capabilities. So if you could, George, just give us a little brief description of the practice and then maybe talk about a case and a quick win, that would be great.
Sure. So cloud computing is being used by more and more organizations every day. More companies are implementing it, trying to just consolidate their systems, save some money. But before a company decides to use a particular cloud service provider, they need to understand and document, assess the provider's physical and logical access and security controls. The organization needs to be satisfied that the proper controls are in place that will protect the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data at rest, data in motion, and data in use. It's important for the organization to understand who has access to the data and infrastructure both within their own organization and the cloud provider's organization. Companies should take these risks into account and should mitigate them to an acceptable level before using the system for production use. In one case, for example, a retail organization used two-factor authentication tokens for remote access. There was a network engineer within this organization who was fired. Before his termination, the insider created a token in the name of a fake employee. And a month after the termination, the insider contacted the IT department using a fictional name that he had created and convinced them to activate the VPN token. Several months later, the insider used the VPN token to access the network and delete virtual machines, shut down the storage area network, and he deleted email accounts across the organization. It took the IT staff more than 24 hours to restore operations, and it cost them more than $200,000 to do so.
That's a great example. Is there a quick win that you recommend in the guide as a way to get started?
Sure. So one thing with the cloud provider, you need to verify the cloud service provider's hiring practices and ensure that they conduct thorough background security investigations on any personnel. And when I say any personnel, this includes, but is not limited to, operations staff, technical staff, and even janitorial staff. We've seen cases where actual janitorial staff have caused conducted malicious activities within the organization. And this needs to be done before they are hired, and it should also be done on a periodic basis as well.
You know, with the cloud service providers, though, George, it occurs to me, you know, some of these guys are pretty heavy hitters, and mm-hmm. they're probably not real willing to have their practices be reviewed or have a potential customer do an audit. They can pretty much say, take it or leave it. So do you actually see instances where a cloud service provider is willing to provide the information that you're calling for in your practice?
Sure, yes. Actually, there's a couple cloud service providers who actually tailor their services to the regulated sectors like HIPAA or healthcare industry, also the federal government. A lot of providers are now starting to customize their services for the federal government because they understand that they have a little bit more rigor and a little bit more controls that they need to have implemented. So I think organizations need to take a look at the company's operating policies and just have that conversation with the provider, see what information they will reveal, and if that's an acceptable level of risk to them, then they can take that into consideration during their selection process.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. I didn't know about that. It makes sense that they would be that the cloud providers would be working hard to meet the requirements of where the controls are more rigorous. So thanks for that explanation. So, Lori, let's give you a crack at this. Let's talk about Practice 17, which is called Establish a Baseline of Normal Network Device Behavior. I've worked in intrusion detection and anomaly detection a little bit, and this idea of a normal behavior profile is pretty challenging. So could you talk a little bit about that and include a quick win in a case as well?
In order to differentiate normal behavior from anomalous behavior on networks, you have to capture and analyze baseline behavior. So every organization has a particular network topology with characteristics such as bandwidth utilization, usage patterns, and protocols that can be monitored for security events and anomaly detection. Deviations from those normal network behaviors can signal possible security incidents, including insider threats. So organizations should characterize their normal network behavior at the enterprise, department, group, and individual levels. That includes ports, protocols, bandwidth, internal and external connection counts, a byte count for email attachment, particular device sets that specific workstations and servers communicate with, and firewall and IDS alerts. That's just some of what can be can and should be monitored and analyzed to see what the normals are, what the variation is, and what's unusual.
So do you find, based on your experience, Lori, that pardon my ignorance here, but I assume there are logging and monitoring and auditing tools that actually help you capture and do the kinds of comparisons that you're speaking of. Is that correct?
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. But often those tools are not put in place, so actually this is a good time to mention one of our cases related to this practice.
Great,
so in one case, there was an insider who was responsible for research and development projects. And in the 4 months prior to leaving for a new job, that insider downloaded a high volume of trade secrets, including around 17,000 PDFs and 22,000 abstracts. So he downloaded those from the victim organization server. Those downloads took place on site and during work hours over just a few 15 to 20 hour periods. So the amount of data that insider downloaded was actually 15 times greater than that of the next highest user. And that data wasn't related to his research. So if there had been monitoring and if there had been a profile of normal behavior, that those downloads would have set off alerts. However, the insider's activities went unnoticed until he resigned, and it was only after that the victim organization found out about his downloads. That stolen IP was actually valued at around $400 million.
Right. So what you're saying in that case is that behavior could have been easily detected if the right tools and the right analysis was in place, correct?
Exactly. So you had asked for a quick win, and I would say that quick win is use network monitoring tools to monitor the network for a period of time and establish that baseline of normal behaviors and trends. It's essential.
Yeah, there's tools out there that will monitor network activity, and there's one particular package that I'm aware of that will alert on abnormal behavior. For example, in an organization I've seen where they do this was that it would create an alert for anonymous or create an alert for high activity after hours. So, for example, maybe a workstation for whatever reason is downloading or has network traffic that exceeds a certain limit. Maybe it exceeds just a few megabytes because you'd think after hours there shouldn't really be any activity coming from that computer. So anything that exceeded that low threshold would trigger an alert.
Right, and it also occurs to me with all the many things that Lori mentioned that could be monitored, perhaps another way to ease into this if you're not doing real aggressive or real sophisticated network monitoring is just start with an area like you were describing, George, data downloads or data accesses after hours, just start with something small and then kind of ease into the larger monitoring activities, right?
Sure, yes, and organizations should keep in mind, too, that it's not any commercial tools that can do this. There's also open source tools out there that can help. So small businesses or companies that just don't have the budget to do things like this, they might want to take a look at some of those open source tools to help them do this. And then once if they outgrow them, they can maybe look at a commercial solution as well.
Great. Well, thank you both for that discussion. So, George, let's talk about the third of four we're going to discuss today. This one should be a little fun because it's such so much on the forefront of all kinds of reporting. So, practice 18, be especially vigilant regarding social media, something we tend to get pretty hammered with day in and day out. So can you say a little bit about that one?
Sure. So it seems nowadays more and more people just want to share everything, post everything that they are doing online. Nowadays, many people are using social media to keep in touch with their friends, their family, and even their colleagues. So organizations need to be aware of some of the risks that this poses to them. In particular, an insider using social media can intentionally or unintentionally threaten the organization's systems and data. Information posted to social media sites could be used to conduct a social engineering campaign against the organization and its employees. Employees need to be aware of the risks associated with posting information online, not only about the organization itself, but also their own personal information just to protect themselves. I feel the only way to accomplish this is through proper training. Training needs to be provided that addresses the policies and procedures about how employees, business partners, and even contractors should use social media. That training could even discuss the dangers of inadvertently posting personal information online that may cause financial or other loss to the employee.
Great. So how about a case?
Sure. So an attacker compromised the email account of a former U.S. vice presidential candidate. The attacker simply used the search engine to find the answers to password recovery questions which included the date of birth, zip code, and where she met her spouse. All these answers were found online through simple web searches. The attacker used this information to reset the password on the account, and he proceeded to read through her email and posted it to a public forum.
Well, that's probably something that could happen to all of us. Obviously, someone in that role pulls a pretty high profile, but any of us could be subject to that kind of an attack, correct?
Sure, sure. I mean, just even looking at, for example, a Facebook profile of somebody, I mean, a lot of people post a lot of information about their personal lives on there. How much of that information could be used to reset somebody's password on any account? I mean, there's a lot of those, a lot of that information could be gleaned just by looking at that person's profile page or just doing some other simple web searches.
Right. And how about the quick win?
Sure. So a quick win for this one would be for the organization to include social media training as part of the organization's annual security awareness training program.
Great. Well, Lori, you have the honor of discussing with us the last practice, Practice 19, Close the Doors to Unauthorized Data Exfiltration, which just by title seems to perhaps relate a little bit to the one you previously discussed, although that for network device behavior, the employee was inside. It seems that one of the things you want to watch for is stuff going outside, right?
Yes. And data exfiltration, first of all, I'll explain or define what it means. It means the organization's data moves to an unauthorized place. So that can happen electronically through physical means, such as printing out documents and just walking out with them or carrying a thumb drive with data. The organization's data on it.
Mm-hmm.
So to address data exfiltration in general, an organization must, it has to first of all identify its critical assets. That's information, technology, and facilities. And then it has to identify people who should have authorized access to those assets, as well as those who actually do. And lastly, it has to determine the asset locations, the physical asset locations for all of those items. An organization has to be able to account for all of those devices, or all devices, not only ones they own, but all devices that connect either physically or wirelessly to its information system. So some example devices that could be used to exfiltrate data include smartphones, thumb drives, printers, scanners, fax machines, MP3 players, microphones, and even video conferencing systems. Internet services like instant messaging and SSH, FTP, and email can be used for exfiltration as well. Smartphones, in particular, can exfiltrate using private connections, private internet connections that the organization cannot monitor. These are just a few, a handful of example ways that exfiltration can be done, and the organization really has to look into all possibilities to try to protect against them. In order to protect against exfiltration, a combination of strategies need to be used together. Policies, technical controls, compliance checks, and physical controls can all help to prevent and detect data exfiltration. The challenge is really to balance security with productivity. The controls need to allow authorized information exchanges, but also prevent unauthorized exfiltration as much as possible.
Right, because as I'm thinking, listening to you describe this practice, this can be pretty daunting, particularly as we talk about BYOD, bring your own device, and all these, as you mentioned, all these, this proliferation of both organizational and personal devices that are connecting to the network. You know, very, very difficult to get your hands around. So I think one of the key things you said is to identify the critical assets, because it seems to me, would you agree that you can't necessarily inventory and monitor all of these, but you want to pick the ones that are most likely to be involved in, or most at risk, if data is exfiltrated either onto them or from them? Would you agree?
You can pick the most at-risk items, and additionally, there can be general policies. You know, an organization has to determine if a policy, say, for instance, against bring your own device, if the security it would provide, the added security it would provide, if that would, if the cost in terms of employees being maybe dissatisfied if they didn't have their smartphones on, you know, in their pocket, that cost has to be weighed as well. So organizations, first of all, have to determine what their risks are, and then make a decision about return on investment.
So this practice could be a little bit tricky for organizations to implement. As I like to say, you need to know what you must protect. And a lot of organizations can struggle with this one because their data is just scattered everywhere across the organization. It can be on servers, workstations, people's personal thumb drives. It could be on their local machine, just sitting in their local documents folder. And they need to kind of get their hands around where all that data is at and understand what type of sensitivity it is. I mean, is it something that the company considers confidential and proprietary? And they need to put proper security protections around that information. And actually, we have a couple tech notes that are being released, two of which have already been released. There's two more in the queue that actually talk about data exfiltration and get understanding where your data lives. One of them actually addresses a open source scanning tool that will actually go out there, scan your network looking for sensitive data. So in order to implement this one, I think that one of the biggest challenges is knowing where your data lives and how to protect it.
That's good advice. So how about a case?
Let's see. In one case, a tax preparation service employed an insider as a tax preparer. And while that consultant was on site and during work hours, the insider printed personally identifiable information on at least 30 customers. And then the insider later used this social security number information to submit fraudulent tax returns using those IDs. The refunds totaled $290,000.
Okay, and how about a quick win?
Restrict data transfer protocols such as FTP or SCP to employees with a justifiable business need and carefully monitor their use. Those kind of protocols can export a lot of data quickly, so that's a good high impact win.
Excellent. Well, thank you for all those examples. I really appreciate it. So we're coming to our close. This has been a very rich and information filled conversation, which I appreciate and hopefully have encouraged folks to look more into this subject. So with that in mind, George, do you have some resources where our listeners can learn more?
Sure. The fourth edition of the Common Sense Guide is available on our website. I encourage everyone listening to review and share the document across the organization and discover how it can help the organization better prepare and defend against malicious insider attacks. And also, CERT's Insider Threat website has a wealth of additional information, including technical controls, some technical notes that can be implemented to mitigate insider risks. The site also has links to our previous podcasts and our Insider Threat blog.
great. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you both so very much for your time, for your preparation, for your expertise. This has been a great conversation. So, first of all, George, thank you for participating with us today.
Sure, great. Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
And, Lori, any last thoughts? I would also like to thank you. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to add?
Thanks so much for having us. Let's see, I guess just like George, I'd direct people to our website. We've got a ton of information that can help people to prevent, detect, and respond to insider threats.
Great. Well, thank you both so much.